And it has been hot in the city, too. The Heat, Miami Heat, living up to its name. Broadcasting from News Radio 610, WIOD here in Miami. Thank you again to Ken Charles and to Jerry Hester, the assistant program director, for being so hospitable, being a good conversation partner before the show got started. And we're looking forward to this part of the show tonight quite a bit. Read the book, A Time for Patriots. Haven't had the opportunity to get caught up with the other novels of Dale Brown, but I've read this one. Not just a successful author, but somebody with a unique market. I would say this is in the vein of Tom Clancy. If you don't know Dale Brown already, and many of you already would, I'm sure there's many of his fans who are listening tonight. But in the area of thriller, techno, aviation, filled with unusual characters, kind of creates his own universe. And we'll talk about that universe and his vision for the near future in America coming up next with Dale Brown. The new novel is A Time for Patriots on this Memorial Day weekend, and we'll get to it next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet. Well, Dale Brown has a history not just as a former U.S. Air Force captain, but also in the Civil Air Patrol, which is central to the new novel, A Time for Patriots. Good evening, Dale Brown.
Good evening. Great to talk to you, Ian.
And congratulations on all your success.
Great. Thank you. I'm having a great time. It's really great that it's nice and warm down there in Florida because we're getting 2 to 6 inches of snow up here in Lake Tahoe.
Are you really? Oh, gosh. How about that? Is that late in the season for Tahoe to be getting snow?
Well, last year we got snow. The last day of measurable snow was June 12th. So
okay.
We've had snow every day of the year
or
every month of the year up here in Lake Tahoe. So you just never know.
Well, ordinarily I live in Minnesota and my wife didn't want to be hearing about the slight sunburn I got when I was at the pool today, because it was like 45 degrees and raining or something. So kind of the same sort of deal. You know, it's so interesting. Your fan base, I was reading your novel while I was sitting having lunch the other day, and guy came up to me and said, "Oh, my dad loves those novels." And I asked whether he had read it. He goes, "No." And I go, "But my dad keeps bugging me that I got to get into him." He said, he's got them all. And I think you have clearly found a real strong, wide, popular niche out there with people who are very interested in aviation and espionage and military action thrillers. And I like the fact that you've created your own history. I had to go back and look up the American Holocaust because I didn't remember it when it happened, but I read about it in one of your novels.
I'm having a great time with it. You know, I like current events. I like geopolitics, but I didn't want to write about the present day. I figured enough other authors write about the present day stuff, and I wanted to take it a little bit further than that, but I didn't want to go into science fiction. So I picked the time frame about 2 to 5 years in the future, and I do a lot of research about emerging technology, what's coming out in the next few years or so, and then I write about it as if that technology exists in the next 2 to 5 years or so, and then I create a conflict, and then to use the technology. And that's the niche that I picked. I don't want present day, and I don't want too much futuristic stuff in there. So I try to pick the in-between area, and I don't think there are too many other authors actually focusing in on that. A lot of guys do the present day stuff, and I thought that was getting too much. And a lot of guys do science fiction, and I didn't want to get into that area. So I wanted to pick the middle ground. And I've been lucky since I've been doing this now for the past 25 years. It's a lot of the stuff that I write about 15, 20 years ago is actually coming true now. So people are writing to me, emailing to me and say, "Well, you're a wizard. You know, you're a,
right.
I mean, you're a genius because all this stuff didn't exist back when you first wrote about it. And now it's commonplace. GPS guided weapons and laser guided weapons. All that stuff didn't exist when I first when I first wrote about it 20 years ago, and now it's all commonplace. And I'm having a great time doing it. I'm very lucky living in the place that I live and doing what I do. I remind myself each and every day how lucky I am to be doing it.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about your vision for the future coming up. I'll mention another name. I don't know if you're familiar with the writings of Ridley Pearson, but he does that too. He does that with crime, and he researches kind of not what's current technology, but what's sort of the next big thing in crime science. And that's what he writes on. And he's had great success with that too. He's a very good guy.
I'm having a blast doing it. And I think that's the way to go. You know, you can stretch it a little bit. You can go out there and you can take the reader in a direction that you want to take the reader to go. You start with a current basis. You start with the real world. And then as soon as you realize that the reader is following you about the first third of the novel, maybe the first half, then you can go off in a different direction. And that's so much fun to be able to do that.
Well, let's talk about that American Holocaust, because it's central to your novel. And I know your readers will know many of the names that would pop up in the book. And this is another Patrick McClanahan novel. But I thought that was pretty interesting when you talked about at some point you envision that there had been some sort of a clash between the United States, the Soviet Union, and China that produced what you referred to as the American Holocaust. Talk about the possibility for that type of a showdown as you imagine it.
Well, the American Holocaust came about actually as a byproduct of 9/11. You know, before 9/11, I think a lot of us techno-thriller authors were very reluctant to sort of step over the edge. You didn't want to get too bloody. You didn't want to describe situations where you kill thousands and thousands of people. You didn't want to go up to that limit. But after 9/11, where we lost over 3,000 people in one day, I think that shattered the limit. After that, authors were sort of freed after that. So what I wrote shortly after 9/11 was the novel Plan of Attack, where I describe a Russian bomber attack using cruise missiles against the United States of America. The Russian president realizes that the United States is on a path to dominate Europe and encircle Russia, so he lashes out, and his decision is to wipe out America's land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles and the land-based bomber force, all in one massive strike against the United States. So he puts together this plan where he mobilizes all of Russia's oldest, most decrepit bombers and loads them up with the most sophisticated for Russia, the most modernistic weapons that Russia has, and he does a complete surprise attack against the United States, against the mainland, against the lower 48 states, specifically targeting the United States land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles and the land-based bombers, and that's what the American Holocaust is. And what it does is it wipes out 50% of America's intercontinental ballistic missiles launched from ground, and it wipes out 75% of America's air-breathing long-range bombers. And so America is forced after that to begin the process of remodernizing all those weapon systems. And that's what I deal with in the next several novels after Plan of Attack, is exactly how the United States will repopulate the bomber force, to repopulate the missile force, and what direction does the United States take after that? Do they go back to bombers? Are they too low tech? Now, I'm a bomber guy. That's how I was brought up. That's how I trained in the Air Force. But but I always question about whether or not manned long-range bombers are the way to go. And I'm always examining the current state of the art, and I'm not so sure that manned long-range bombers are the answer. So
that's are drones the answer
in the next several novels?
Are drones the answer? I mean, all of this unmanned technology that's out there that's being driven by joysticks thousands of miles away?
See, I'm not convinced about that. I think eventually the state of the art will advance where the aircraft will be able to think for themselves. They'll be able to pick targets for themselves. I do write about things like that. I write about unmanned aircraft with sensors that are precise enough, and they have processors that are fast and smart enough to be able to look out over a large area and be able to pick out their own targets. But the state of the art isn't there yet. Like I said, I focus in on the next two to 5 years. I believe that technology will come, but it'll be in the next 10 to 15 years. So I don't believe, I know we're doing more and more unmanned aircraft, and I write about them, of course.
Right.
But I still believe that men will be, men and women, will be in the loop for the next 5 to 10 years easily, probably 15 years.
You know, what's the trade-off? I mean, just aside from whatever you've written about, what do you think is the trade-off for unmanned vehicles delivering a military punch?
Well, the trade-off is you produce aircraft. If they don't have a man on board, if they don't have two or more humans on board, they have much longer endurance. They have you can put more weapons on board. You can put more fuel on board. They can stay aloft longer because obviously you don't have to rest those people on board. You don't have to worry about humans in the cockpit. You don't have to produce systems, environmental systems, and life support systems to sustain humans on board. That's the good part of it. The bad part of it is if once you get over enemy territory and you've made it through and you're over the bad guys, exactly how do you go about picking out the targets? Now, you can use satellites and you can uplink and downlink all this stuff, but if you can't discriminate targets and you can't decide which is a target and which is not a target, then all this unmanned stuff doesn't make any difference anymore because you can't strike the target anymore. So I think that's the trade-off. You get aircraft that have incredible capabilities that can stay over bad guy territory for days and days and days, but if you can't find the target, they're no good. So I think once the technology catches up, where those aircraft can pick out their own targets, or you can have those aircraft communicate with satellites and with people back at the headquarters on the ground, then those unmanned aircraft will have real value. Now, you're talking about from 2010 to 2015, it's just not possible yet. We're almost there, but we're not there yet. And since I don't write about things that happen 10 years from now, I don't necessarily want to write about that right now.
You know, I'm curious, though, too, about the effect of there's something about, and you kind of hint at it, too, in A Time for Patriots. There's something that's kind of unnerving about unmanned observer planes or even attack weapons. There's something about it for people on the ground that know that they're being watched by something that's flying overhead that they can do nothing about. Or in the case of the theater of war, where somebody feels attacked by something where there's no risk by the whoever the attacker or defender is, there's no risk by putting up an unmanned plane. And so all that matters is on the ground, that person feels like there's this, you know, they really feel the dominance of somebody who has the technology that allows them to not put any human lives at risk. And I think that begs somehow a stronger response, a resolve from people on the other end who feel like, how dare you not risk your life if you're coming after mine?
Well, I think you're going to have some enemy forces that will think exactly like that, that we need to strike back harder because they have those unmanned aircraft that can orbit overhead for 12 hours at a time, that launch from bases that are 500 miles away, and they're being controlled from the United States. But I think there's also a lot of the enemy forces who start to worry about things like that you can't see those things up there. They're up 5,000, 9,000 feet in the air, and they can watch you, and they're watching you all the time, and they have a laser guided weapon on board, and that could make you think if you have a constant pattern, if you have a pattern of travel that can be tracked and that can be monitored, that has to bother you after a while. When you realize there could be an aircraft 5,000 feet above you that you can't see, that you can't hear, but they can watch you and they can track all your movements and they know where you come from and where you go to, that has to bother them quite a bit. And I think that's a huge advantage for the United States of America. I think any conflict that we get involved with, we have to leverage that technological advance. We have to use that technology to the maximum. And I think that's what we're doing. I think that's one of the few things I give President Obama credit for, is that he's using unmanned strike aircraft to the maximum extent. And I think that's making a difference on the battlefields in Afghanistan and even Pakistan. We're using technology in a way that we should be using it.
Yeah, I know we are. And I know that I think that everybody embraces technology because it comes with that built-in lower risk to human life for us. And I just wonder how many, I've already heard it mentioned a couple of times as being one of those rallying cries for the people that we're coming after, is that they intend to make us feel it eventually, that we can use our technology like that kind of eye in the sky stuff, or even with an advanced weapon, without putting any of our lives at risk. But that I think it steals the resolve of the people that want to come after us, that somehow they'll find whoever it is that's at that joystick and make them know it. But I think that some of that was already in your novel, that there's a battle going on for America and a time for patriots. And your vision in the near future allows for Americans fighting Americans fighting the government choosing sides on which Americans are going to get a special look. And then we're into the domestic terrorism scenarios in a time for patriots. So before we get to the bottom of the hour break, what was your inspiration for the domestic terrorism in a time for patriots?
Well, some of the research I did for the book had to do with a lot of threats to governors around the United States. These extremist groups, mostly based in Nevada. There's a few in Oregon, a few in Washington State, but these groups are actually threatening American state governors with violence if they didn't back off investigations, prosecutions against some of these groups. And that just amazed me. How in the world can you threaten a governor? But I think that's the nature of the condition that we're in, especially if the economy in the United States does a double dip recession, which is what I describe in the book. I think those groups will rise if we do have another severe economic downturn, and I describe the U.S. president's response to a double dip recession, where he seems to make the situation worse. And so that's what I really wanted to talk
about.
We'll
pick up that thought then, coming up in just a minute with Dale Brown, A Time for Patriots. And I've got a question for him. we're roughly the same age. I want to run something by him from his youth and my youth, in contrast to the book A Time for Patriots, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. I kind of like the aviation aspect of A Time for Patriots. I want to talk a little bit about the Civil Air Patrol. It's central to an understanding of the plot development in the latest book by Dale Brown. We'll talk to him about how he puts the reader into the cockpit and takes us into the danger zone of a battle for America, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So, Dale Brown, in A Time for Patriots, you talk about domestic terrorism. And so, I've been watching this over the years, and I'll throw something at you and then see where you are with this.
All right.
Growing up, roughly about, I'm a little younger than you, but roughly the same age. And all of the domestic terrorism I knew as a youth was all from the liberal side of the political spectrum. It was all, you know, all the violent protesters were disenfranchised youth. They felt forced to fight in some case. I mean, I'm painting with broad strokes here, but generally a feeling of drafted to fight for an establishment whose values they did not share. Liberty wasn't about liberty from paying taxes, but it was freedom from, you know, oppression in other forms of speech, the right to do drugs or smoke or to, you know, to tune in, turn on, drop out, all of that. But there's this shift, and it's rare to hear about any type of violent liberal protesters. Now it's switched to the other side, and now my kids they've actually find it a little hard to picture the liberal violent protesters of my youth. They've never known that. All they've ever known are the ultra, and I'm using this word here not because of your title, but the kind of self-proclaimed ultra patriots who declare themselves not residents of the United States, or declare their understanding of the Constitution to be superior, and therefore they aren't going to abide by laws. That's they've grown up with that, and I still struggle with the shift between the terrorism of the 60s and early 70s of blowing up, you know, armored cars and taking the money to fund these counter revolutions, and the terrorism of today, the domestic terrorism of today. Got a thought on that?
Yeah, I don't classify it as a liberal versus liberal, progressive, reactionary type of political views from that. I look at the economic situation purely, at least in the book, at least in A Time for Patriots, I look to see what the possible response to the entire spectrum of communities and towns within the United States, at least the ones that I'm familiar with here in Nevada, exactly what the response would be if we have another severe economic downturn, even worse than what we experienced in 2008. And my thought would be that no matter what political persuasion you're from, that communities and neighborhoods and even entire towns would band together. They wouldn't be reliant on the county or the state or the federal government for survival anymore. They would rely on each other. Neighbors would rely on neighbors, and neighbors banding together into communities, and then communities banding together to form enclaves with themselves. I believe that's not a political thing. That's a survival situation after that. And that's what I describe in the book.
Oh, I agree with that. But I was really more referring to the Knights of the True Republic.
Yes.
And that organization that, as the novel kicks off, does an act of horrible domestic terrorism. And it seems very much an anti-government position, this idea of the true republic. and claiming a kind of superior understanding of the Constitution, and that's what I'm speaking to, not the grassroots communities that had, you know, that were appropriately sharing resources and trying to find new ways to survive.
Mm-hmm. I think organizations like what I created in the novel. What I tried to do in the novel is to focus in on patriotism and volunteerism and giving back to the community. But I didn't want to tell the reader which are the good guys and which are the bad guys. I wanted to talk about those ideas of you know giving back and protecting your community, protecting your neighbors, protecting your family, but I've got two sides. I've got the true Republic. I've got the extremists, and I've got the Civil Air Patrol guys, and I've got Patrick McClanahan leading his little Civil Air Patrol squadron.
Sure,
but I don't want to tell the reader who the bad guys are and who the good guys are. I want the reader to decide for themselves. When I present those two sides, I want to show every aspect of both sides. And there are certain things that the extremists do that are clearly designed to protect the community and to protect themselves against people like radical elements in the FBI who are going against them, who are trying to invade the community without warrants just because they're different. You have groups like the FBI going against the True Republic, and right. You have groups like what Patrick McClanahan designs in the Civil Air Patrol. You have cadets doing surveillance on innocent civilians, and is that a good thing, or is that a bad thing? Is what the True Republic does is what they do when they protect themselves and they protect their community. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? And I want the reader to decide, and that's what I present in the book: the idea of patriotism, volunteerism, giving back to your community can be both a good thing and a bad thing. And I want the reader to decide for themselves.
I get that. I guess I was going with what you had said earlier too about how you had designed some of this after this radical group had threatened state governors. And the FBI was investigating, because we talked about this at the time. This was like over a year ago, right?
Right.
And that the FBI was investigating this group called, and I thought this is what you were using as a model in A Time for Patriots, is the Guardians of the Free Republics. This is the group that was, you know, had dedicated themselves to restore and re-inhabit the free American republics, and they were threatening governors that they thought were too liberal, or that they thought were, it wasn't that they had done anything other than just, you know, in the case of the governor of Kentucky was considered too gay friendly. And so that they had threatened their life there. And I thought, okay, I thought that was your model for for one of the groups in the book. I understand your idea about presenting all sides of groups, but anytime you've got somebody as an organization that says, I'm going to shoot these deputies, or I'm going to shoot this guy over here so that I can advance my agenda, I don't struggle with whether that's a good or a bad thing. I don't sit there and think, well, in the end, does their philosophy triumph in a way that would justify those actions? I think anytime you take somebody's life in pursuit of something like that, whether it's liberal or conservative, that's wrong, right?
Well, I wanted to take that a little bit further than that. Yes, the action, I mean, just making the threat, just, you know, threatening a governor, you know, some individual or even a community in the middle of nowhere in Nevada, threatening a governor of the state of Tennessee or even Nevada, just, I mean, that's not much of a threat to me. But yes, as I describe in A Time for Patriots, that they they actually take action and they strike out against the federal government, yes, that's a crime, and that needs to be pursued and that needs to be punished. But the other actions, what causes those groups to rise, is what I wanted to explore in that. And the motivation for the creation of Patrick McClanahan's sort of high-tech surveillance group out of the Civil Air Patrol Squadron, and what causes the rise of these extremist groups, I believe, are the same. Both groups want to do the exact same thing. They want to protect themselves. They want to protect their families. They want to protect their neighbors, and they want to protect their communities against who they believe is a threat to them. And
right.
And I mean, however they act, I have Patrick McClanahan outfitting the Civil Air Patrol Cessna 182s with high tech surveillance equipment, and he's virtually spying on the people around him. He's spying on innocent citizens. Is that a bad thing or is that a good thing? Some people perceive it as a bad thing, and that he shouldn't be doing that, even though what he's trying to do is track down the bad guys.
Right. Go ahead.
Is he crossing the line by surveilling on innocent civilians while he's trying to go after the bad guys?
And that's, well, let's talk about that outside of the character, because, you know, obviously most people wouldn't have had a chance to read the novel and can't talk about it in the context that you presented there. But just in general, when private citizens surveil other private citizens, how much leeway should they have to be able to do that?
That's a really great question, and I want to push those boundaries a little bit.
I know. Well, I'm asking you, what do you think? What is that, you, Dale Brown? When is it too? When does somebody go too far?
Well, I think that's the perception when you feel that you're under a certain level of threat, and you have the capability. This is exactly the same thing that Patrick McClanahan and the others around his Civil Air Patrol squadron deal with in the book. Exactly,
right.
Exactly what threat level do you take your response up to the next level? I mean, Patrick McClanahan knows, along with his friend John Masters, they have the technology to scan the entire area, and they could look for the bad guys, and they could possibly find the bad guys, and he knows he has the technology to stop them. What level of threat does the situation have to rise to before he goes to the next level?
I think
you have to be in a position on the ground, ready to react, and if you have the tools and you have the will to do it, I think you should make the decision after that, and it's also dependent on how you feel is the support from the government. Now what I've presented in the book is that the federal government's response to the double dip recession is two things: is to cut taxes by 50% and cut government services by 50%. So and obviously that rolls downhill after that. The states start to cut back, the counties start to cut back, and the local governments start to cut back. If you feel that you don't have the support from the federal government anymore, then you're more likely to use the technology and use your own personal will to respond to the threat that you perceive around you. So I think depending on the circumstances, you're more likely to use your resources and use your weapons to respond to the threat as you see it. But that's both on the good guy side and the bad guy side. It's not just, I mean, Patrick McClanahan does this, and the extremists, the True Republic, do the same thing. Who's the good guy and who's the bad guy? And that's what I wanted to present.
I understand. I'll be honest with you and say I'm a little bit worried about losing some of our listeners who haven't read the novel and can't quite relate to it in the context of the fictional framework. And so that's why I was trying to broaden it out beyond just as you present the scenarios in the book, because a lot of people haven't had a chance to read it yet. And whereas I understand your point perfectly, having read the novel, I want to see if we can't get in kind of a little bit more of a nuts and bolts kind of real world scenario for us to have the context of this conversation. I'll say it again, or I'll frame it from my position. I think I'd be worried in an era when there would be some people who would have access to this kind of high tech military gadgetry that they may act for the best interests of all. They may have the type of temperament that would allow them, which would give them the freedom to be able to make the choices that you would need to make in order to preserve the greatest amount of liberty for everybody. But as soon as we start dealing with perceptions and we start saying, well, if you perceive it to be a threat, then that justifies your actions. I think we run into this sort of thing all the time where people say, I felt threatened by what you did or said, so I got to kill you. I get to shoot you because I feel threatened by that. And that really is ultimately a denial of somebody else's very right to existence, all just based on a perception. And so that would be what I would be worried about in a real world context of this, of people, of how uneven the playing field would be.
Yeah, I think in a situation, in a real world situation where you perceive the threat, I mean, to yourself, I mean, it's not just, you know, what's going on in the country today, but what the threat is that you feel to yourself, to your family, to your community. I believe that's what judges your reaction and what tools you have, whether or not you bring all the tools that you have to bear. I think if you actually reel deep down inside yourself, you believe there's a threat to yourself and your family and to your home, and you have the weapons, you have the tools available to stop that threat, then you have an obligation to do it. I mean, whether or not that's murder, is that against the law, is that against the rules of civilized society, I think you have an obligation to do it. And I think if the economic situation in the country did deteriorate to the point where the local government or the county governments or state governments can't protect you anymore, I think you have an obligation. If you have the tools and if you have the will, you should use them. And I think you have an obligation to do that. You have an obligation, obviously, to protect yourself and to protect your family. And if you have a community of like-minded people, you have an obligation to use those very same tools to protect your community.
Even though that means innocent people will die, even though that means then that somebody who's not been convicted of, not even charged with a crime, not certainly not convicted of one, stands the risk of being executed based on the perception that somebody might have that you in the future might be a threat to my family, therefore I'm going to preemptively kill you, even though that would fall under the category of murder. If we had more police, as you project in the book, a time when the amount of police protection at various levels of government goes way down, or the ability even in a court system to handle all that, that this would somehow give somebody who had, say, enough, you know, personal weaponry to go out and even the score with their potential enemies, just because they perceive that person might be a threat to their family?
Well, I'm not sure who you mean by innocent people. I think if there's a threat to yourself or to your family or to your to your home. I mean that has to be a real threat. And obviously, if you're psychotic or you're not perceiving reality properly, then innocent people could be a threat to you. But I think if you're cognizant, if you're perceiving reality properly, then I think you can make the determination whether or not somebody or some organization or some other group is a threat to you, and you should be able to respond.
All right. Well, let me give you a real world scenario on that and see how you feel about it. I understand how it's presented in the book, A Time for Patriots, Dale Brown, taking a look into our near future. I want to talk more about the Civil Air Patrol and the role that it plays both in our country, an unsung role for the Civil Air Patrol. We'll talk about that too. Coming up on Coast to Coast.